Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr. And no Christine this week. Paying job, last minute thing got in the way, and she lives a ways from home. So Long Island traffic, also a block. So we have to go ahead without her, which is unfortunate, because we're very excited this week to have with us Elise Sperber. Well, two people. The two founders. Let's start that over. The two founders of the San Francisco School of Needlework and Design is who we have with us this week. One of them is Elise Sperber. Hi, Elise.
Hi, Gary.
And the other is Lucy Barter. Hi, Lucy.
Hello, Gary. Hello.
There we go. Now, both founders, really appreciate you guys taking the time, because I really wanted to explore this San Francisco school and what you do and how you do it. And so we're going to get to do that, and that's just great. So appreciate the time. And
thank you for inviting us.
Yep, and everybody should know they're sharing earbuds to record this, so it's going to be an hour of coziness in San Francisco.
That's what we're all about over here.
Yeah, there we go. So okay, let's start first with, so people understand how you each got into stitching. So Elise, tell me, you know, just quickly, what is your background? How did you get involved in stitching and needlework to the point that you would be even interested in starting a school of this magnitude?
Well, my family history is based on people who made their professions as tailors and embroiderers. My great-grandmother was a professional embroiderer and came over from Eastern Europe and eventually via England.
Okay,
Lise,
I'm gonna stop you right there. Can you move the mic closer to you or halfway?
Lucy
between?
Has it up her sleeve.
Oh,
she doesn't want to hear my voice. So yeah, it was the way that I got into needlework was via a family history where my great grandmother was an embroiderer, my great grandfather was a tailor. They came from Europe via England, from Eastern Europe. And then my great-grandmother had a shop in Los Angeles where she embroidered blouses and sold them. And I learned embroidery from the time I was young, and my mother taught me needlepoint. And then I got involved with Eastern European culture and dance and song, and started was trained to restore costumes from different regions of Central and Eastern Europe. And that's how I got my start. And that was a long time ago.
So very, very, very traditional start for most people learning from your ancestors. But boy, that costume thing, that had to add a real dimension to it.
Yeah. The motifs and the colors and the movement of the costumes and how embroidery worked on costuming really set apart for me the way that you embroider and how you think about it. And for me, which is different than some of the other training that I've had, you know, what is the weight of the embroidery do when a costume moves? What does it do when you spin? What do you see? What do you not see? So, yeah, movement had a lot to do with how I thought about stitching and motifs.
Okay, that's our next show right there. Just to understand that has got to be fascinating. Wow, what fun. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I guess I kind of miss it. Haven't done that kind of embroidery for quite a long time.
Yeah, well, that's got to be a real different challenge and aspect in many ways. I mean, you really got to be thinking as you do that.
Yeah, there is a process involved that's very cerebral, where you are always thinking about it. But at the same time, it still brings you the same sort of hand rhythmic motion that creates that sense of calm. So it's a little of both.
Okay. Yep. That's a show. We're doing a show. You're on the list. Lucy, how'd you get involved?
Well, I started out with embroidery in school growing up in England, and come from a family of creative people. And all the way through school, I enjoyed art and painting and textiles. So then I went to university and I studied children's fashion design, but I specialized in kids design, where I worked in embroidery. So I kind of have been doing it all my life. Came out to the US and was working out here for some pretty major high street names, Gap, Gymboree. But I found out about the Royal School of Needlework Apprenticeship Program and was very fortunate to get a place back in 2003. And so that started my embroidery career, really, with quite the, you know, huge appetite. And here we are. So putting it out there to everyone else.
It's interesting that really for neither of you, it really wasn't a hobby. Can I say that? It's basically ingrained in your life then.
Certainly. I think hobbies were or are now quite different to embroidery. So, yeah, this was always work for me.
And I'll just say, for me, it was a bit of a hobby. So in the years when I was raising my children, I had a different career. And I did embroider as a hobbyist during the years when I was raising my children, and came back to it after they were standing on their own two feet and able to feed themselves well. And felt like I could then go back to doing what I originally always thought I was going to do. So I told my mother when I graduated from high school that I was going to be an embroiderer. Mm-hmm. And she gave me that look that mothers give you that just sticks with you. So, I did have another career earlier on in my life as well as a sign language interpreter for deaf and deafblind people. So during those years, this was my hobby.
So that was the job where at least you can be an embroiderer all day long, but you got to get something that'll pay, right?
That's correct, but I was still using my hands.
Yep. There you have it. Yeah, there. That's how, yeah. That works from the parent perspective. Okay. But see, it's interesting, at least, that you would have it as a hobby, but still it was part of your heritage and your background. So unlike me, who just picked it up as something I enjoy doing, you have much more behind it than just a simple hobby thing.
I think I can't breathe without it, and I would say that's been true my whole life. Yes.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. It just really is, most people in this hobby are just like me. It's something that you pick up, learn from somebody else, and you find you enjoy it, and it gives you an escape. And then to talk to people who, you know, to say I'm going to be an embroiderer the rest of my life that's not a statement that's made every day. So, yeah.
No.
Here's
two of us sitting here with the same thoughts.
I know. I know. That's just it. So what brings you together such that you would start this school?
Earbuds.
Well, Elise and I met quite a few years ago now. Can't even remember what year we met in. While I was teaching the RSN certificate and diploma out here in San Francisco, and we met on the course. And
Lucy taught me.
I taught Elise one or two of her techniques there, and she was an excellent student. She's pinching me right now. Oh.
She was
a great student, but we had we just had the same vision, and we would discuss things, and we knew that there was quite an exciting future for embroidery in this country, but certainly here on the West Coast. And we started formulating a plan.
I think that we both, at the heart of it, felt that we got so much joy from it, mm-hmm. and we wanted to spread that joy as far as we could. We wanted people to feel that they could create with a piece of thread and some fabric anything that their heart desired, mm-hmm. and that we could guide them through it and make them feel happy and proud of what they accomplished.
Yeah.
And I think it really just came from that wanting to spread joy through this medium to others.
So was it a cup of coffee, let's start a school, or was it a cup of coffee, let's offer a couple classes and see how it goes?
I think we jumped in. We might have had a bottle of wine and
alcohol was involved. Okay.
No, I think we no, from the get-go, I think we were thinking big. It's why not? You know, it's not out there right now. We need to do this. And there was a calling for it.
I live on coffee. Lucy drinks no coffee. So it wasn't over. It was a glass of wine for her and a cup of coffee for me. But I think it was more of an evolving conversation, a progressing conversation. We had excitement from the first time we started talking about it, but I think there was an evolution of almost getting prepared to do it. But we continued talking over, I would say, at least a year before mm-hmm. we actually sat down with a paper and pencil and tried to draft a plan.
Okay, so you did, it was literally a formal, let's put a plan together. This is the structure of this school. This is where we want to start and where we want to be down the road. And I really literally had envisioned that you just started out, offered some classes, things took off, and you said, hey, we can make more out of it than this. And so you saw this. Well, I mean, you got to be of this type. The only school in the States? Can I say that? Roughly?
We think of this type of school that has breadth of course offerings that is true.
Yeah.
We don't know of another that's like us, which was one of the reasons that we thought the school could be successful. We did draft up a business plan. We did decide to become a nonprofit entity. We did go through all of the steps to do all of that, to set ourselves up before we opened the school. So we incorporated and became a nonprofit months before we actually even opened the school. So it was very thought out.
That's interesting, because so many of these things just evolve into something. So number one, to have the vision and say, hey, this can be something right out of the gate, and then to implement it is fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And we kind of, the one thing we were lacking there was somewhere to operate from. That's the time-consuming part that took us a while to find the right space.
Yeah, that was my next question. Mm-hmm. All right, where does a school start?
In Union Square, San Francisco, of course.
It took us almost 18 months to find a space. And we started with Lucy with one baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Lucy with two babies in tow as we're looking at mm-hmm. spaces. We didn't have an easy time. We didn't, we're in a very competitive city. And there's a lot of startup organizations with, tech companies
right.
who didn't look like a nonprofit hand embroidery school that we were in competition with for spaces. So it was a challenge finding a space that we thought was a place that people would want to come to take classes, especially if they were coming for extended periods of time for longer courses. But once we found it, we built it.
So did you have a, because I would agree, if you're going to start something entrepreneurial like this, you're certainly in the right area of the country and certainly the right culture, because that mind, the mindset out in that whole area is let's start and see what it becomes. But did you have a nucleus of stitchers in the area to draw from that gave you confidence in starting this?
Not really. I think we knew, we certainly had people who were kind of keeping an eye out and following us. But as soon as we opened our doors and started getting the word out, we've discovered this whole new existence out there who are interested in what we're doing, and of all ages. And that's been rather exciting. We thought we would have the stitcher who enjoys the very traditional and historical elements of embroidery. And we have had designers like Marie-Sophie Lockhart from from New York who wanted to come teach for us as soon as she heard about us and brought in a new wave of, you know, younger generation wanting to embroider their denim and everything. So it's been rather a fascinating journey to go on with meeting our kind of daily walk-ins. So, yeah.
And that's interesting that young people would play a role in this thing early on. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, Christine and I have talked many times with people about how to involve and how they are involving young people in the hobby and getting them interested. And I think there's a at least a nucleus of a movement in the stitching hobbies as a group of young people getting interested. As we've described it more than once, people are finally realizing that staring at your phone all day is just not mm-hmm. not always productive, and looking up and saying, what else can we do? What can I do that might give me an escape? And many young people finding stitching as a way to do that. But you had that right out of the gate. Again, is that a culture in San Francisco, or were you finding that all over?
Well, I think that we started attracting people with an introductory series of classes that we put out, which is a series that has six different classes. In each class, you can learn eight new stitches. So you could build this vocabulary. But we started doing sort of these more casual evening events. Some of them were in collaboration with another nonprofit. Some of them were when Marie Sophie would come, and we would draw in these younger people. And we wondered why we weren't seeing them in the introductory series. So finally, a woman who is a designer here in San Francisco of like silk robes and stuff looked at one of them and she said, oh, that's your introductory class. And she looked so intimidated by it. So we realized we needed to go down a little bit. So make it, you know, break it down into smaller bites in terms of both time and financial investment and scope. So we started what we call our bite-sized classes. And that's when we really started seeing waves of people coming in, waves of younger people coming in. It's 3 hours, and you learn 4 stitches, and you have a sheet of paper with a bunch of different designs. You get to pick whichever fun design you want to do. We actually got the idea because we did a bridal shower, and we were going to do napkins. So each person who came to the shower was going to embroider a napkin for the bride and groom, and the bride liked robots and dinosaurs. So that's what the motifs were. And so we actually based these bite-sized classes starting with robots and dinosaurs, and then we added some mm-hmm. flowers and peace signs and
sugar skulls and yeah.
So that's what started people coming in, and then we've now created another series of classes called our Technique Tasters. They're also 3 hours, so it's not a huge investment of time, but you learn a little bit of whichever technique you choose, gold work, white work, applique, what else is in there?
There's black work, stump work, needle painting, needle point, so it's quite varied, and we're seeing a lot of traffic come through in those classes. And the bite size as well, it's interesting because we're seeing groups of friends book on, so they're coming and trying something out together. And then we may see one or two of them come back and repeat classes, or they jump into the intro series then.
You know, that really is interesting because I've, in other circles, told this story more than once. I've been doing magazine editing for a long time. And at one point, and this was before we had the kinds of graphic layout and design capabilities we have now, I wanted to do, it was for a burglar and fire alarm magazine. And for people who installed and designed systems. And I wanted to do a series of special articles, one each month, on how to do a burglar and fire alarm system in a given building or type of building. And the first thing I did was I went and traveled to a whole bunch of people who did this work and asked the question, how, because I didn't know how sophisticated to be in this design, and on how, at what level, I didn't know how to present it. And across the board, I talked to probably a dozen different people. Across the board, they said just what you discovered, that you can't be too simple. Do it at the simplest level, and that will be where you will reach the most people. And on top of it, the people who are experienced or think they're experienced will learn because they'll have forgotten something. And mm-hmm. and I've wondered that in the needlework business hobby, if that isn't, you know, the kind of a recipe that we don't, you know, maybe we just simply overwhelm people sometimes. Here's a project, do it. And you know, here's the steps, just read them and execute it. But it's not unusual for people to you can just tell they're just a little overwhelmed, they're not sure. And you know, people who freak out about moving from Aida cloth to linen, and mm-hmm. and people who have done it just say, well, it's not that big a deal, but it is for them. It's a big switch, and they're not sure. And it's that basic little step that helping people over it helps them move on. And so that it's just so by offering these little snippets of technique or whatever, that allowed people to get dip their toe in the water, basically.
Yeah. We also, like with our entry ranges, we have a doodle cloth. So you practice your stitches first, and it takes away that fear of stitching straight onto the silk with silk. So you're practicing, and it kind of breaks the ice. And then we really encourage people to make the designs their own. You know, if you put a stitch somewhere and it's not what it says on the instruction, then that's just fine. And we're seeing a lot of people come back and sharing their work with us. You know, they've added a different color, or they loved one stitch, so they've used it in different places. So we're really trying to, we put design into our name for a good reason, and we're trying to encourage that within people's work, so you don't have 12 giraffes all coming out looking exactly the same.
Right, and it starts as soon as with the bite-sized classes. So we teach them four stitches. We show them lots of examples of their motif stitched lots of different ways. And we don't even have a stitch plan with those classes. They determine where they want their four stitches to go. So mm-hmm. we start from the very beginning classes here, encouraging people to use their own sense of thought mm-hmm. to create their own piece, so that I don't think we've ever had two come out looking the same.
No, no. And they get to choose their colorway as well. And we encourage them to share colors with other people around the table. So they're all friends by the end of the day. It's great.
So that I must stitch it the way it was designed exactly mm-hmm. mentality that takes people, many people, years, if ever, mm-hmm. to break out of, you don't even let it form then.
Not on these classes. There's a training program for that. So and that is in development. So, you know, that's where you want your, you know, the technical aspects to, if you're working a large project and you need 12 stitches on that project, then you have to be of a similar standard. So that comes later, but getting people in, you know, with those bite size, we may not see them again, and we just want them to have fun, talk about us, and come back really. But and they are doing that, so it's a lot of fun.
And we do have people even now starting to draw their own elements onto the motifs. So we've had on the dinosaur, we've had people do fire breathing dragon instead, so they've reworked it. We've had people come in with their own drawing to do that class. So we're starting to see people understand that they can come here and make it their own. And we'll support them through the technical aspect of it, and then they'll leave here with something that truly is their own, even if we just gave them the foundation for how to get it started.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, no, it really is. All right, now we have a school of needlework and design. So we have black work, mm-hmm. crewel, counted thread, canvas embroidery, gold work, needle painting, 3D, white work, and stump work. You have all those things, and I was trying to picture, what does a typical week look like at the San Francisco school? What do we have? I mean, because your schedule is packed.
Yeah, it's busy now. yeah. with everything that we have, people and things that keep walking through the door that just, you know, we have to think carefully about. But in between all those technique classes that we're teaching, we do clinics. So how to mount your work, how to frame up a slate frame, how to transfer designs. We do things like and these are regular. They happen every 2 to 3 months, maybe. And we teach color and design as well. So these things are scheduled into the program. A regular week, however, it's different every single week.
There isn't one. Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, for example, today we had a planning meeting to plan some future programming. And
volunteers in today as well.
Volunteers,
busy volunteer day.
Volunteers help us with kits and with inventory and with books for our library and getting them recorded and cataloged and donations and making sure that we are, you know, have the proper list of ways to document a donation. Because we're a nonprofit, also we have to do that side of it. We have people training for a collaboration that we have with a shoe brand in this afternoon. Like, every day is pretty packed with a variety. So there's no class today, but it's a very busy day here. And every day is sort of like that.
And then we have all your visitors that walk through the door. We had someone from Texas, Arizona, Australia today. So, you know, it's exciting to hear their stories and how they found us and what they want to know from us. And so that's the interesting part, I think.
So you get to pause. You get to pause the day and just talk stitching with a drop.
Yeah,
in.
We do. We take the time to do that. You know, they might have brought a project to show us and share. And yesterday we had a lady in from Australia again, another one, and who was listening to a conversation. She was in the room at a stitch in, and there was a conversation I was having with a past student. She was updating me with her work, and turns out they'd been on the same stitch retreat in England last year. So then they sat down and had a catch up, which, yeah, it's fun to see and hear what people are doing.
But we do have regularly scheduled. So every Wednesday is a stitch in, and anyone from anywhere is welcome to come and sit and use our space to sit and stitch. I mean, we've had people who are cartoonists come and draw cartoons, but anyone who wants to do, you know, has a creative pursuit who wants to come and sit in here to do it, can do that. So that's every Wednesday and one Saturday a month. And one of the Wednesdays every month, we have a collaboration with the San Francisco branch of the Embroiderers Guild of America, where we're doing something we call Lunch and Learn. We alternate between ourselves and them in terms of planning the events, but we're bringing in stitchers from a broad spectrum of both artistic pursuits as well as ages, and having little lectures, little demonstrations, sometimes little hands-on work. So it's an hour-long thing once a month on our Wednesdays. So we try to bring a lot of people in for a variety of reasons, and we do also have community outreach. So we've just been doing in San Mateo, going to all the libraries and doing some little classes in the libraries in San Mateo, which is the county just south of San Francisco. And we had another nonprofit called Social Justice Sewing Academy in last week or the week before, who it's a quilting organization for the most part, but we had three young ladies from
Baltimore,
and they each were working on a social justice quilt, and they wanted to add some embroidery. So they came in, they shared their quilts and the stories of their quilts with us, and then we taught them some stitches to add to their quilts. We've had we have groups from other nonprofits that work with individuals with developmental disabilities coming in. We keep ourselves pretty active. Then we have some museums that we work with. We have the Exploratorium, where we've done a couple of evenings with them where they have the museum open, but they have special events, and we'll do tables where people can sit down and stitch. And we're working with the Contemporary Jewish Museum on an exhibition they have coming on the Jewish wardrobe, and helping them put together some programming and some samples for people to look up close at what that stitching looked like. So we got a lot of stuff besides our classes.
We thought we'd like take our time, like we do stitching, you know, have all this time in the world to kind of put things together, and we're just too busy, which is great. It's a good problem to have.
That's fantastic. When you started, you certainly couldn't have imagined being involved in all of these things.
No, we did not anticipate this at all. No. So,
but it sounds like if someone were to camp out there for a week, the exposure to all aspects of needlework would be rather mind-blowing, I would think.
Yeah, we have stitch retreats, so you can actually come and camp out for a week twice a year right now. So we have people who come in for a week-long retreat. The last one we had from Maine and Alaska and all over, and they come in and they work on a particular project, and depending on the project that they've brought, we will pull things from our collection. They get to use our library. We teach and demonstrate. Then the students learn off each other, and there were some great connections happening while people are here on those retreats. So that's rather fun.
Talk about that library. That's pretty extensive.
Well, my house is a little emptier now. Yeah, when we started the school, I donated over my personal library that I've been collecting in all the years that I started my kind of career in embroidery. And that was it was close to 2,000 books then. And since we opened, only just opened our doors just short of 2 years ago, we have grown that library to over 3,000 books, which we've got some very, very rare titles in our library.
Let me just back up. 3,000 titles.
Yes.
Related to needlework.
Relating to needlework, yes.
Wow.
Yep. And they're
I'm on the next plane. I'm on the next plane.
Yeah, we only have a small section on knitting or crochet. That will build in time, but at the moment it's needlework relating, yes. Historic books, we have a very growing quite quickly antiquarium section to our library as well. We just gained a donation of 150 books a week ago, of which we've got some very rare Scandinavian and European embroidery technique books in that particular donation. So the library is rather fun to be in. We had two fashion students in last week who just came in for our stitching to read the books. And it wasn't the fashion section they were looking at. It was all of our historical books and things. So, it's great. Great library. And growing.
What a resource.
So much fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a... So describe this building to me, the building you're in. You have obviously some office space. Is the library literally a library-like space with bookshelves all over? And then you have classrooms, a central area. What do we have?
So we're in an office building. It's kind of unusual. We're right on Union Square, so we're across the street from Union Square. And we're in the office building above Tiffany's.
So you have to close your eyes when you walk in and not go shopping.
I can easily walk right by that stuff. That's not a problem for me.
Well, we have a harder time.
Yeah.
For a while, they were doing some construction, and they put the entrance to Tiffany's inside the hallway that you have to walk in, and it was really hard to either come into the building or leave without stopping.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think we spent some lunch hours there. But so we're in this office building on the sixth floor. And when you walk in, you walk down this very sterile hallway. And when you walk in, you walk into our library, which is a big long wall of books, long library tables, and then some other small walls that have bookshelves on them as well. And they're floor to ceiling. And they're a nice warm wood color. So the whole room feels very
inviting.
And we have a tiny shop that's in that same big space. So that's our biggest, largest space. And we can seat about 24 in there for classes or events if we need to. The tables we have all come apart and move, and we can rearrange furniture. So that you walk into the library, and then we have straight back from there a very small office where usually about three people or sometimes more are sitting. And on either side of the office are two classrooms. One is larger, and it has tables in it. And the other room, right now we're using as a project room to help us lay out our programming ideas and work on other stitching projects for classes. But we can move furniture around in such a way so that when we have the need for using trestles, we just move the furniture and we do so. We have a small little kitchen and design room combined, and a little area that we use just for ourselves for storage or for cutting fabrics and things
and,
like that.
Exhibit area as well. Within the library and the classrooms, we have these great walls for exhibiting and showing our collection pieces or local embroidery artists' work. So.
Yeah, and we call it the Hanging Thread Gallery, and right now we have a book.
I love the name, by the way. I love the name.
Thank you. Right now we have the portfolio of work from a woman named Jillian Creelman, who graduated from the Royal School of Needlework in 1953. There are some really beautiful and amazing pieces in here. Plus, it has all of her artwork that she did pre-stitching that goes along with it. We have sketchbooks of hers. It's quite a resource. And then we put our, we do challenges three times a year, and we use the gallery to display the challenge pieces for a month after the challenge pieces come in. Have you done one of our challenges, Gary?
No, not yet. But
you're kidding.
I have to say, in doing research for this, I'm going, holy smokes, those look like fun.
Yes, yeah. Tell
people about these challenges, because that really, that cost me some minutes in the website. Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, they came about quite by accident, really, didn't they? In the beginning, when we opened our doors June 1st of 2016, but in September we had an official opening, and we invited all the locals, and we wanted to include people from afar who couldn't physically walk through our door. So we decided, with only 6 weeks' notice, to design the design actually was inspired by Tiffany's and California. So we did this, Annalie designed a Tiffany window. And we sent this out to people. They could download it from the website and interpret it however they wanted, whatever needle technique they wanted to use, or whether it be felting. We had 35, I think it was, entries come in, which we thought was pretty good for 6 weeks' notice, from 12 different states of the U.S. and 5 different countries.
Hmm.
So we thought, hang on a second, this might just be a thing. And then Elise had a – you were working with Nest and the Swarovski Foundation donated upcycled crystals for us to use. And so we did an under the sea challenge, which saw 86 pieces come in from, I don't know, were we at 20 different states then, and then 12 countries?
Yes.
And since then, we've grown that a little bit. We've now reached up to 40, we're actually 40 states officially, and about 35 countries.
Wow.
So our current challenge, the pieces are coming in daily. The deadline to get your piece in is the 14th of August. And it's burlesque, which was sponsored by Krynek Thread. And we are seeing some fascinating and fun and lively pieces come in. And so those will be exhibited. And with our challenges, we have an online gallery.
And so we do have... We do put the pieces up in our Hanging Thread Gallery for the month after the pieces come in. So the burlesque, if anyone wants to come and see it, will be up the month of September. And then when that comes down, we do put an online gallery up so that people's work is displayed. And we ask people to write a little bit of something about what inspired them for each piece and to name their piece. So we do give everybody a little bit of credit and try to share a little bit of their words and keep that as a legacy on the website with their piece going forward, so everybody's piece gets to stay somewhere alive out in the world. Our next challenge, though, if you're interested, will be announced on September 1st.
Okay.
So stay tuned for that.
All right. Well, you have an hour of my life with the burlesque challenge. because when I was looking at that and I what are they doing? But boy, did I get an education. Wow, that was fascinating. Because you have on that page, you have history and you know the what the definition of burlesque is, and what I'm a smarter person today. I have to tell you, that was good.
We try to do a very in-depth inspiration page for each of the challenges, and we do try to dig deep because we don't want people to give us something flat. We want each person to truly dig inside themselves on these challenges, both in terms of stretching their imagination and reaching farther in terms of what they thought they could technically do as an embroiderer. And we've had so many people come back to us and say that they, you know, they didn't think they could do a challenge because it really didn't speak to them. But then when they tried and they actually got into it, that they learned so much about themselves and they learned so much about how to create by having this freedom to just take a theme and move with it.
Mm-hmm. There's a good example of that. Just last week, I was teaching at the EGA regional seminar in Sonoma, and they have a display of people's work. Everyone puts in their pieces, and I recognized two challenge pieces. And at the banquet on the last evening, they announced the winner of the People's Choice design, and it was a lady, Laurie Love, who did our Under the Sea challenge. And hers was picked above everyone else's. And the one thing she had said when she walked in through our door to deliver that challenge to us was, "I'm so glad you challenged me," because she was, you know, she would stick to the instructions. She completely designed this all by herself. She kind of jumped outside the box in a big way and created this piece. And it was fantastic to see her win the prize for that. And our challenges, however, are free to enter, and there is no competition about them.
They're no competition.
Not at all. It's all about freedom to stitch. And we've touched people who have been battling illness or who are housebound, who have never stitched before or who haven't stitched in a long time. And you can either send the piece in or photo submissions. They will all get shown. And it's just wonderful to see what people are doing. So
that has to be really heartwarming when you help people beyond just giving them a hobby.
Yeah, it definitely is. And we've been very fortunate to have at least one item donated to our collection from every challenge that we've done. And I think we had a particular challenger who sadly passed away just recently, and she had all her threads ready for the burlesque just before she passed, and we have her piece in our collection, and she really did tell a story with the works that she did. So it's something that needs to be in people's lives, and we've managed to do that with this particular kind of last minute thought that we had when opening. So
yeah, that's all right.
It's a thing now.
Yeah.
It's turned into a lot of work.
It's a lot of work because we have to accept people's pieces. We have to mail the pieces back. We have to create the gallery. We have to create all the labels.
We have to think up the challenges.
We have to think up the challenges.
Get the partnerships. We need to employ a challenge manager or something. I don't know. It's a thing now.
Well, that's great. That's just fantastic. That's it's approachable for people. No cost. Just make the effort.
Mm-hmm.
I love
it. We have nine 9 people that have managed so far to enter every single challenge. So that's
really
impressive too. Yeah. And they, I mean, they are coming in from all over the world. We're really having fun with putting the pins in our map.
Yes. And, you know, we're continuing to look for, we love collaborating in a lot of different ways, but on the challenges, we've had 3 collaborations so far, or maybe 4. We're trying to do 1 a year. So for the burlesque, it is with Krynek, and then we had DMC last year for the Summer of Love Challenge and Swarovski the year before. So we don't know yet what will happen next year. So that's another, like, a little bit of a strain, but we will continue to think about who we might collaborate with and what a great theme would be for whatever product we can get.
And it gives you a really effective outreach to people who might be intimidated or simply don't know about you or whatever. That's a terrific way to connect with people too.
And then I don't want to forget that Anna Garris-Goyser, who is the name behind Talia Farrow Designs, also has collaborated with us. And one of the challenges, she gave us designs of hers to use, which was fantastic. And I think she recently reached out to us, and she's going to do something on her website encouraging people to do what they did in the challenge, which is take her blank design and create their own piece with it. Yeah. So.
And we're encouraging those people who enter the challenges to then enter their local fairs. Because a couple of people, one person in particular, had done Anna's design, stitched it and put it into the fair, and she won a day class to come here to SNUD. So
there we go.
And ribbons. So we're encouraging people to, you know, put their work out there. It's important work that they're doing. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is, of course, this time of year is state fair time. And it's fun to see people who have actually, you know, put their stiff spine in and entered something, because, that's quite a leap. I think it would be for me to enter something to be judged. And to see people have success, get ribbons, get recognized, and find success with their hobby is fun to see. So, yeah. Go ahead.
I do think one more thing about the challenge is that, you know, getting your piece displayed here where there is no judgmental piece to it or no judging piece to it, I think also is a confidence builder for taking that same piece of artwork or another piece of artwork and putting it out in the world for a greater exposure. I just think that is another part added to the challenge, is that people are getting their pieces up. They're seeing that people come through and love what they've done. And I think it's a big confidence builder. I think a lot of us never feel like confident about showing people what we do. So that's one of the reasons we do it. We want to help people share their work.
Yeah, well, and that is a factor, I think, throughout the hobby, is that confidence. Yeah, show your friends and family members, but to show other stitchers who know what you've done and appreciate it it can be intimidating for people. You give them the outlook. That's great. The outlet. That's great. Yeah, talk about the internet and social media and the role it plays with the school. You must make heavy use of it.
We do. we do. It's neither Lucy nor I are the ones who are running that part of the school, but it is a really important piece of the school. So we try to keep our Instagram and our Facebook pages alive and interesting during the weekdays with different events that happen around the school or interesting articles that we might find or beautiful images. We want people to see what's going on at the school. We've started doing some little videos now and again around the Krynek Challenge. Anna Lee did some videos showing how to use some different things you can do with the Krynek threads. Lily is our marketing and communications coordinator, and she does a fantastic job. So along with the social media piece, we do a newsletter, which Lily does write most of on her own and puts together. And she does a fantastic job. She's been with us since January, and we love her dearly.
I did see Lily taking pictures of us up close with the, sharing the earbuds, so watch out.
Tell Lily I want one.
She took them while we were in our separate rooms, but yeah, I saw her sneaking some pictures. Yeah, but we're just keeping people up to date with what's going on, and we are seeing a lot of following, or visitors are come in from certainly Facebook. It's doing us some good.
It's interesting. It's such a critical communication tool these days. But as anyone who has just tried to keep a blog up for an extended period of time, it takes a lot of work. And if you're really busy with classes and developing new programs, you really need someone that can dedicate to it, because I know for me, especially in my paying job, you know, it's like I should do a post on our website, but I'll get to that later today, because right now I just don't have time because I have four deadlines screaming at me. And pretty soon the days go by and you realize you haven't done anything. And I think I know a lot of blogs that I follow in the needlework world, as time goes by, the posts get less and less, because it takes a concerted effort. And yet, if you're doing it and doing it well and consistently, you really become a resource and provide, you develop a real strong following for it. And I know that with these podcasts that we do, doing them twice a week is a lot of work. But we build the following up, and it's fun, and we're sharing information. It's the same kind of thing, but. Boy, you have to be persistent, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to plug away.
Right, and I think that's why we have a person dedicated to the social media and the newsletter and communications in general. Also, we do some print ads or electronic ads in a few different publications, and we try to keep those fresh and refreshed. And it's just good to have somebody who's got an eye on it, overseeing it all the time. And that's Lily, as I said, but also we have Annalie Levin, who is what's her job title? Director of Community Engagement. So Annalie is one of our instructors also, and the rest of her job is doing all of the different kinds of activities that we do outside of the school, like with the libraries and museums. So Annalie's sort of in charge of doing what's outside of the school. Lucy's our program director. She is in charge of all of the programming for the school, and then trying to wrangle and schedule the rest of us. Not such an easy job, by the way. A lot of strong personalities. We have an executive director, Laura Maloney Ratte, and that's it. That's our staff. I'm not on the staff. I'm really happy. So I had been doing many, many jobs. And so when we hired Laura as the executive director, I started taking some of my hats off. And I do what's needed at this point. So right now I'm working on the library. I call myself the emergency teacher.
We're designing some new classes and stitching again.
Yes, I'm designing some classes and stitching again, because actually for the first 2 years, I don't think I picked up a needle at all.
I don't need it. Well, other than the samples on our walls, no.
Well, that was the next thing I wondered about. Does everybody who works there stitch? And exactly that. When is their time?
Not everyone, well, certainly when starting didn't stitch, or they have different needle arts interests. So crochet, mm-hmm. knitting, for two examples. But you have to make time in life to do these things. It's hard for me. I've got three young kids at home. So although I have one of them stitching. And
all right. Victory.
Yeah. He's only four. So pretty good going. But yeah, we you have to make that time because it's important for us. And then we have to schedule time here to get our sampling done, and we've got some rather exciting projects to work on at coming up for launch in not that long, actually.
You should tell deadly. About it.
Well, we're going to be rolling out our certificate program in January.
What's it called, Lucy? We just came up today, and we've been arguing over it for months. What is it?
It's Comprehensive Studies in Hand Embroidery. I think I just wrote the title down, so I need to remember.
Comprehensive Studies in Hand Embroidery.
Yeah.
And when do those start?
January. Mm-hmm. January 14th.
Are you ready?
I think it's our time. No, but we will be, yes. It's very exciting. And as we say in our title there, it's going to be very comprehensive. And we're covering design, the fundamentals of the techniques, the technical aspects, and then a creative project. So we'll also have many samplings here to view, and people will just it's going to be exciting. And we've got a lot of interest so far, but we're putting word out officially in our next newsletter.
I think you just did.
Well, and I've just done it now. Yeah.
So this will be a certificate program over the course of 2 years, 3 years.
We have our first two techniques: surface embroidery and gold or metalwork. We're calling it, but we'll cover the gold work being launched at the beginning of the next year, 2019, and then there'll be six modules in total, and with future ones in the running. But yeah, it's something that people with this the layout of it as well is going to be either you can do it as a block or come back and work your different levels at different times throughout the year, trying to make it affordable and fit within working people's lives and, you know, with jobs and things like that as well. So
right, each technique will be composed of three different levels, which is what Lucy means when she says levels. And it's not something you earn over time for taking, you know, for 2 years or whatever. When you complete three levels of one technique, you would earn a certificate for that technique. And then there's goals, bigger goals that will come as people progress through the program. But each technique will be its own comprehensive, in-depth study of that technique.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that it really is kind of a self-paced thing in terms of, but then you get these modules and gain a certificate for each one.
Well, one of the things we've realized is that we have to build flexibility in. People don't, you know, people work now and, you know, or they need childcare, or they have vacation time, they want to take their classes during their vacation time. It's just really, really hard. So we tried, this has been one of our biggest challenges, is trying to create schedules that have flexibility built in, that people can try and arrange their lives to fit into doing what they want to do. And we hope, you know, when we roll it out, we will learn something. We've learned something every time we've rolled something out, how that schedule works. And hopefully, you know, we've been as thoughtful as we could at this point without any more information coming from actual students and or people who would like to be students. So once it gets put out on a piece of paper that other people can read and think about, I'm sure we'll get feedback. And over time, we may tweak it. But right now, it's got as much flexibility built in as we could imagine for it. So
yeah, that's got to be the one thing with anything like this is you put together a plan, you think you have it, what'll work, and then you put it in the wild and oops.
Yeah.
We have to adjust. Yeah.
Yeah, there's always going to be someone who'll miss out, but with our intro classes, the class that runs on a Saturday eventually will repeat on a Thursday. So if you work a weekend, you can come in on a, so we're just trying to, wherever we can, create more evening classes, weekends, Sundays are good as well. And we're trying to cater as much as we can for everyone.
Well, I have to say, this is fascinating. It is a lot more than I expected out of this by a long shot. I went through the website and tried to learn as much as I could, but boy, you guys, mm-hmm. This is fun. This is just fantastic. Well, and I mean, there's just so many options for anyone either to explore the technique that they're interested in or to find new things to try. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you're clearly making it approachable at all levels, and that's fantastic.
So. Yeah, I think that certainly was important with the starting of this, you know, the conception of the school. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we're still building. I think, mm-hmm. you know, we got ourselves going with getting new people interested in embroidery, and now we feel confident to we're going to work on those people. We're going to help those people work on themselves. To bring in people who want to dig deeper, mm-hmm. who are already, you know, hankering to do a little bit more than what they can do on their own. And speaking of that, I think that one of, you know, the hallmark traits of the school is that we do believe that we want people to work together in a community, that, you know, stitching is something that we all learn from each other. You don't mm-hmm. just learn it from a teacher. You don't learn it just from watching a website. You learn it from the person sitting next to you, and you have something to teach other people as well. And we want that to be a part of what happens inside of the walls here, is that there's a lot of interaction going on, and that people are continuing to learn from each other. Oh, why did you pick that color? Oh, that's so interesting. And that stitch looks great there. And what would you do here? Oh, I would, you know, maybe add a little of this, from each other, not just from, you know, the instructors here.
Well, this is fantastic. I've got a bunch more questions, but we're out of time. So that means mm-hmm. you have to come back. I mean, just, okay. That's just the way it is. Just the way
well,
it is.
Well, we'd love to. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep, enjoyed it. Thanks to everybody for listening, and Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.